like me. Today, I'd like to say that the Feast of Tabernacles is like the hermit crab. Today, I would like to say the Feast of Tabernacles is like collecting seeds. Not only these type of seeds, but all of you. How can I say that? But why do I say that? Okay, I got three books here I'm going to play with. First off, I'd like to go into the scriptures, which is the foundation of all knowledge and all understanding. Start off in Genesis 1:1. No PowerPoint presentation yet. Genesis 1, verse 11. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, seed-bearing plants, fruit trees of every kind on the earth that bear fruit with the seed in it. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, seed-bearing plants of every kind, the trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And that evening, there was a morning in the third day. He saw that it was good. So it must be important to him. Okay, let's look at that Hebrew word. I'd like to look at that Hebrew word for seeds. Seed-bearing plants. Okay, the Hebrew word is zarah. I'm going to write down the three main characters in the Hebrew. We read from right to left. To the best of my knowledge, at this time it's pronounced Zarah. And translated 221 times in the Bible as seed, also translated as child, and also translated three times as carnally, and also fruitful, seed time, and sowing time. So that's all in the meaning of this Hebrew word, zarah. Okay, now I'd like to break down the Hebrew letters. And this will be the end of my PowerPoint presentation. Okay, the first letter is related to the letter Z in our alphabet. It's called, in the modern Hebrew, they pronounce it Zan, which means food, cut, or nourish. So in Hebrew, they break down the symbols for the meaning of the word. They add the symbols, which have meaning themselves, to make a greater meaning to the word, which we're referring to seed in English. So the second letter, thank you. second letter is referred to in English language as R, which means first, top. The actual pronunciation is like resh in the Hebrew, resh, but it's related in the, as R in our, best we know in our English language, but it means first, top, or beginning. So the next part of the word picture is the last letter, which is an AN. PowerPoint presentation done. Okay, so if we go through these three symbols in the meaning for seed, which is the Hebrew word zerah, you'll see if you break down the word picture, the first letter is related to our Z in the alphabet, which means to food, cut, or nourish. The second letter is R, or resh, first, top, or beginning. The third letter, the third main letter, that they also have jots and tittles, which make these symbols into vowel sounds. But I didn't go into that. But these are the main letters, which is usually silent, but if they add a little certain jot to it or tittle, it'll pronounce the ah sound. So it's watch, know, or shade. So to get a little deeper meaning in just seeds, or all of you, seeds, in the Hebrew, the meaning of it, it starts bringing out a word picture to me anyway. So third, like fruit, food, this is a type of food. To cut, here we cut these plants, it's all interconnected. To nourish, just in the simple, and we just put it in the one English word, seed. First, top, beginning, watch, know, and shade. So I'd like to prove that this is actually scientific. Scientific. Today, if you ask the young people in school, science takes me away from God, our creator, my sustainer. I don't believe in a creator because science says there is no creator. Is this true? Okay. So let's go to Genesis 1. We went to Genesis 1, verse 12. Let's go to Genesis 1, verse 29. This is the same Hebrew word used in Genesis 1, 29, zerah. God said, "See, I give you every seed-bearing plant that is upon all the earth, every tree that has seed-bearing fruit, they shall be yours for food." Okay? Now let's also go to Genesis 3:15. This is the same Hebrew word. To glean a little more deeper understanding. English is very limited. Seed doesn't give the full meaning of the word. 3:15. "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. They shall strike at your head, and you shall strike at their heel." Okay. So this, I want to look at this scientifically. Do we have any proof of this in science? Okay, let's look at the stars. As the stars actually prove to us, there's a message about this very scripture. If we go 4,000, I'm referring to a book that's written by creation scientists. It says, "Unlocking the Mysteries of Creation." 4,000 years ago, God asked Job many questions, including some about specific stars and well-known star groups. "Can the stew bind," this is in Job 38, 31 through 32, "canst thou bind the sweet influences of the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Nazareth, the 12 signs called constellations, in his season? Or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons?" Orion is universally known as a heavenly sign. God authenticates its unique name in the Bible. Orion means coming as light. It is one of the several star groups that identify a mighty man coming to triumph over the great enemy of mankind, the serpent. It is the first prophecy in history to promise the Redeemer for mankind, alienated from God by sin. Cursing the serpent in the Garden of Eden after Adam was found, trying to hide his newly revealed nakedness, God prophesied in a graphic word picture, and we just read that. And I will put enmity between thee, the serpent, embodying the devil, and the woman, between thy seed and her seed, which shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. So we have a word picture illustrated representing a seed, and that seed being our elder brother, our Creator. Before Job, before Babel, and before the Great Flood, fathers recounted the heavenly portrayal of Orion to their sons. The coming of the Prince of Light holds a great club in his right hand and the token of his victory in his left. The head of, and skin of the roaring lion, that is Satan, the sign shows Orion's left foot is raised to crush the head of the enemy. If there's any doubt about the identity of this Orion, all we need is to examine the ancient names of the notable stars in the figure. The brightest in the right shoulder of Orion is named Bethelzebuz, which means the coming of the branch. The next is Regal, seen in the foot positioned over the head of the enemy. There is the seventh brightest star in the sky. Regal means the foot that crushes. In the left shoulder of Orion is Bellatrix, which means quickly coming or swiftly destroying. One of the three stars in Orion's belt is named Omnicta, the wounded one. The star in his right leg is called Sapha, meaning bruised, the very word in Genesis 3:15. Should it surprise us to learn that Orion is the most brilliant of all the constellations? If the glory of God is intended to be declared by the stellar heavens, Psalms 19 is likely that their storyline in the 12 signs called the Nazareth by God himself in Job 38 signifies the eternal plan of the Messiah, who alone is the brightness of his glory, Hebrews 1:3. The Hebrews, the Aztecs, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Chinese all have the same 12 constellations with the same essential meanings. To look at the stars, there's no reason to group them as they are in the zodiac, except if it was divinely designed to tell a story. Modern astrology is simply a perversion of God's original intention, and the real meaning of the zodiac is truly an awesome revelation. Okay, so does science take us away from our Creator? I think not. So we have the seed coming as a picture in the stars, coming as light, as Orion means. Okay, let's turn to Genesis 4:25. This also uses the Hebrew word Zerah. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth, meaning God has provided me with another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain had killed him. And to Seth, in turn, a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Okay, so we have that same Hebrew word used in verse 25 of chapter 4. So we see another meaning of seed, which is related into the meanings. Okay, so let's go to Genesis 7, verse 3. If you're not convinced yet, a little broader definition of seeds. Of the birds of the sky, also seven pairs for the male and female to keep seed alive upon all the earth. Start back a little further. Verse 2. Of every clean animal you shall take seven pairs, males and their mates, and every animal that is not clean. Two, a male and its mate. Of the birds of the sky also seven pairs, male and female, to keep seed alive upon all the earth. Again, Zerah. Okay? Genesis 9, verse 9. Same Hebrew word. I now establish my covenant with you and your offspring to come. Offspring, Zerah. Okay, Genesis 12, verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abraham and said, I will assign this land to your offspring. And he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Again, Zerah, the seed. Okay, so we can see there's quite a bit to this definition that if we just look at the English word that we're missing. Okay, I want to go more to unlocking some of the creation knowledge and just refer to examples. What can we learn from our creation? Or does it take us away from our Creator? I'd like to refer back to this book. And what can we learn from the creation? Some say it's just physical, it doesn't mean much, but I say otherwise. According to the report by scientists in the science journal Nature, what does geckos have to do with seed? Are small tropical reptiles whose ability to walk on walls across ceilings have previously defied all attempts to explain how they could stick to any surface with no sign of any glue or suction mechanism to hold them on. A group of biologists and engineers studied the microscopic hairs on geckos' toes and found the ends of the hairs directly attached to the molecules in the walking surface by van der Waals forces. I'll say it's our Creator's forces. A type of attraction between atoms. The report concludes that engineering a structure like the gecko foot is beyond the limits of human technology. But scientists expressed the hope that the natural technology of the gecko foot hairs can provide biological inspiration for the future design of remarkable effective adhesives. Well, our Creator already did it. If understanding how to manufacture gecko foot hairs is beyond the intelligent human engineering, it is certainly beyond blind, mindless chance. The more we look into the precision engineering found in living things, the more we are reminded of the Apostle Paul's warning that human beings who study the created world are without excuse for ignoring the Creator. So what can we learn from this spiritually? This is a physical fact. Geckos have little hairs that they actually attach to the molecules in the wall or any climbing surface. So what can we glean from that spiritually as seeds? And see, what we're looking for is our Creator has created all these seeds, the plants, you and me, animals, describing His characteristics. So what type of characteristic can we glean from this knowledge that geckos have fine hairs that actually attach to the molecules of the surface they climb? Any thoughts? Is there any spiritual lesson in this? Anyone? Any other thoughts? To the atoms, which is our Creator. Any other thoughts? Exactly, you're all correct. And also, what did I just do with the word seed? We delved into the actual atoms of the word, did we not? Do we actually delve into the atoms of our owner's manual? Or do we just read over the English word seed and not really glean from what we could? See, there's so much knowledge that our Creator has, just even in the little gecko hairs, we could actually attach to the atoms of the meanings of His creation. Okay, so but why did I mention the hermit crab earlier? Why did I mention seeds? Because we're learning about characteristics of seeds of creation. Okay, next, nature's chemistry. The phenomenal firefly. Have you ever seen a living light? In many places around the world, people are fascinated by the common little flying beetles often called fireflies or lightning bugs. There are many varieties, and they don't look too outstanding, similar to us. But wait until dark. What a show they put on. This is interesting. They show up in the dark. What a show they put on. The little taillights flash and glow brightly as they mysteriously communicate with many other fireflies, nearly using their lights as signals. It is believed that they use their lights in selecting mates and to attract others to discover in the discovery of food. Of course, other beetles do quite well without built-in light bulbs, don't they? So why would a firefly evolve? Even more puzzling is the question of how firefly could evolve. The amazing ability of living creatures to produce light has been named bioluminescence. The firefly produces light by a complex process that scientists are only beginning to understand but cannot duplicate. A unique chemical named luciferin, have you heard that before? Is combined with an enzyme named luciferase, plus another compound produced by the bug's little body called ATP, adrenosine triphosphate, mixed in just the right portions and in just the right timing, light is produced when oxygen is added to the formula. The light from the lightning bug is sometimes called cold light, because the energy conversion process is so efficient that no measurable heat is formed. Contrast this with our standard light bulbs that convert about 80% of the energy they use in heat. If it worked that way in a lightning bug, they would get quite toasty whenever they turned on their lights. If they left the lights on too long, well, don't worry. The firefly was created perfectly able to avoid the problem of overheating. How many everyday creations with complex chemistry do we take for granted? Think of the chemistry that converts food into the muscles of our body, or that converts light entering your eyes into the imagery in your brain. Complex chemistry is all around us as a testimony to our Father's awesome works. So what spiritual lesson can we learn from the lightning bug? I thought it was interesting. They've actually named it the enzyme after Lucifer, luciferase. I thought that was interesting. It gives us a little more insight into our creation. But is there any spiritual lesson we can learn from this chemical process? Light in the darkness. Correct. Anything else? Any other thoughts? Chatty? Yeah? Any other thoughts? Spiritual?
Does that being evolved is milk and matter?
Yeah. They have a little picture on here that says, okay, they got two little lightning bugs looking at this test program. It says, evolution adaption testing ground, top secret. Okay, you were right. We need to evolve an inhibitor. The thing explodes. Okay. So we can see from this chemical process, there's also more to glean from this. It says in the right combination of oxygen, is not like the spirit related to oxygen in our spiritual walk. So if we can glean his words, his light, but also adding his spirit into our thought process, we can be the light of the world. Okay? And how did you do that? Through the spirit of oxygen, right? Huh?
Communicating with one another. In fact, even light flash off every 2 seconds, and others flash off every 3 seconds. They attract different things because of the way they flash off.
Yeah, that's a very good point. They said that. They said that it's selecting mates, attracting others to discovery of food. So are we, like Paul and all of the sermons, are we attracting others to the food of the Spirit? See? Through our life. Okay, so we learned a little bit from the lightning bug today. Seeds of creation. His characteristics that he's looking for, not us. In 1980, this is the bewildering bombarder beetle. Anybody heard of the bombarder beetle?
Bombardier.
Bombardier beetle. Okay. In 1981, the edition of the World Book Encyclopedia Science Yearbook, a fascinating article begins. The bombardier beetle is one of the many insects that makes the use of complex chemicals to protect itself from its natural enemies. You can identify this bug found under rocks near water, especially by its beady black eyes. It has a yellowish-orange head, chest and legs, and greenish-blue wings covers over the back part. It's not more than 3/4 of an inch long. Upon examining this creature in the laboratory, biologists have discovered that inside the bombardier beetle's body are two special chambers that produce two special chemicals. Hydrogen peroxide and hydrogen quinone. These chemicals are mixed and sent to a storage chamber that is connected to a second chamber called the explosion chamber. Through a muscle that acts as a control valve, the explosion chamber has a number of small external glands feeding into it that add an enzyme catalyst. When this happens, a violent cannon-like explosion is sent out the strategically positioned tube at the rear of the beetle's body into the face of a would-be attacker. The hapless predator is left gagging in a steaming, noxious smoke as hot as boiling water while the beetle scurries quickly to cover under the next rock. His special turret, like artillery fire, with accuracy is what in whatever direction is necessary. Witnessing a real miracle. Can you imagine, if evolution were true, the extremely delicate defense systems of the bombarder beetle before it had ever evolved to be fully functional? If the chemicals were not just the right strength or of just the perfect ingredients, could you see the picture of the Mr. Bombarder beetle manning his battle stations for the first time? If it fizzed, his inadequate protection would be just so much extra baggage, allowing his predators an advantage that would be bad news for Mr. BB. What another possible hazard. If the inner chambers of the tubes were perfectly organized from the beginning, or if the control valve did not close when the explosion took place, think what would happen. He goes to take a deadly shot and it backfires. Mr. Bombarder beetle is blown to pieces, or his innards cooked by his own defense mechanism, and he never even makes it to the endangered species list. If you don't have a college degree to recognize that a multiple of precision details had to be working perfectly from the beginning of this lowly bug's existence. Okay, so what spiritual lessons can we learn from the bombarder beetle? Anybody? Paul?
The bombardier beetle, number one, is not just one explosion. They estimate that maybe as many as 50 to 100 little tiny explosions that take place on a range of them. So that's the estimation of one explosion that takes place. And the rear end has a heat shield in progress to protect the bug itself from those explosions. So it is so fast that all we hear is a snap like that. And the other thing is that the male bombardier is known as pop, and the mother is known as pop. There is no lineage of anything in the world realm of nature from which the bombardier beetle could have evolved. It is exclusive to itself.
Terry?
Not two. He can't.
cannot produce, that he can't not produce. He's able to do everything or anything that he desires and make it work. These are miracles that take place around us all the time. We just need to be aware of them, and we need to study into them and evaluate them, and we can see how God is really working. He works this way with us, too. He works miracles in our lives. Things we cannot see, comprehend yet, but we will.
Can anybody think of an example in the scriptures of this, where this actually happened? Spiritually? Terry?
There's miracles in the Red Sea and in the crossing of the Jordan. There are miracles and healings that have taken place. We've had them even among us where there have been miraculous healings. I've had it personally happen to me a number of times, and I know others here have had the same things happen to them. They're just miracles you can't explain. You just know that God did it, and he uses different mechanisms to do it. But God is real. He's very much aware of what's going on with us. We just need to get more and more in touch with him, in tune with him, get on his frequency and see him in every facet and every phase of our lives. And then we have more and more power coming from him.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hey, for the Bombardier Beetle, I think it just kind of shows God's sense of humor, too, because here's this little beetle running along, and this predator thinks it's going to be an easy shot, you know, and all of a sudden this gets sprayed in the face, you know. To me, it seems kind of humorous.
Dad, do you have anything?
Maybe I'm just...
Yeah, I was thinking of a biblical example, and I was just thinking in my mind, and all I could see was when Mary was impregnated, we've got two forces coming together in the right force or the right perfect balance, and we end up with an explosion and an energy and a force that cannot be reckoned with.
The example personally that I thought of James, go ahead.
Think of the Apostle Paul, where he thought he was going after an easy target, but ended up getting blinded by God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the example I think of is Lot. Why do I think of Lot? Because did not the angels blind the people that were trying to get them outside their home and so they could flee to the mountains? I think that's a perfect example of blinding your enemies so that you could flee. Okay, move on. More creation knowledge. Learning the characteristics of the seed. The jewel of the sky. Has anybody heard of the jewel of the sky? What could I be referring to? It's a bird. I'll give you a hint. Hummingbird. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. If you have ever watched the amazing gyrations of the hummingbird around the liquid feeder, you can't help but sense the deeper meaning of the word awesome. With some 300 varieties worldwide, the hummingbird is the smallest bird in nature, weighing less than a tenth of an ounce. He has much in common with the helicopter. The aerial acrobatics fly backwards, forwards, sideways, and hover in midair. The wings beat at an incredible 80 strokes per second, and their hearts beat 1,000 times a minute. They inhale 250 times a minute, and their metabolic rate is so high that it must feed almost constantly. But since there are no rods in the hummingbird's retina for night vision, its vital processes shut down to a state of hibernation at night. This is different from ordinary sleep, and unlike animals that hibernate in the winter only, the hummingbird hibernates every night, except when the female is nesting. Then she stays awake to sit on her eggs. Every night, the whole body slows down and the temperature drops to conserve energy. The nest of the hummingbird is not much bigger than a postage stamp, made out of thistle down and cobwebs, and built into a pint-sized bird is one of the most complex flight mechanisms known. The wings rotate at the shoulder socket, giving them the helicopter motion to maintain the high energy output. Hummingbirds get their fuel from the nectar plants, which is high in sugar. As they hover at a flower, they can draw 13 sips of nectar a second. with specifically designed beaks and tongues allowing the extraction of nectar deep inside the blossom of the flower. They must remember which blossoms they have drained and return in rotation to allow each flower they visited to produce a fresh supply of nectar. They can't afford to waste energy trying to extract nectar from empty flowers. What would you say if someone told you they believed a helicopter evolved without a designer? Knowing there is no other bird or pre-bird creature, living or fossilized, that even slightly resembles the amazing hummingbird, with its integrated features, and the sensible thing to do is simply admit that there is, again, is another telltale example of the Creator's awesome design. Is there any spiritual lessons in this jewel of the sky? Jim? Yes, Jim said we have to feed excessively or all the time on our Creator. I thought it was interesting. We have an animal that's alive during the day and hibernates at night. I thought that was interesting. Any other thoughts? Paul?
My mother and my aunt raised a lot of flowers. So we had a lot of hummingbirds around our house. Hummingbirds that are, they become tame real easy to people. My mother would frequently just very carefully cradle a hummingbird and she could hold that. And they're so fragile, they're so tiny. They have no defense for themselves. And yet, they choose their nesting site very, very carefully. They don't just nest anywhere. The hummingbirds around our house chose the wild rose bushes to build their nests. And they would fly into the tiniest and hardest of little locations within the wild roses and build those little tiny nests. As a child, I used to crawl into those rose bushes and I would just sit there and watch them hatch their babies and raise them, fascinated by them. They're absolutely brilliant. That's why they're called the jewel. The ruby-throated hummingbird, which is the ones that we had in northern Minnesota, they look just like a brilliant gem. They're just so shiny, so beautiful, and have such awesome brilliance. And yet everything about them is dependent in such a manner of, there is no defense. They are so tiny. They make easy prey. And yet in God's loving care, He allows what we would call a thorn or a briar or a bush that we would look upon it and we would say that is a plant that is not desirous for us to have around. What farmer wants briars or thorns or that type of thing? And yet it dwells within the safety of that, that briar bush. And those wild roses are actually one of the best sources of food for that hummingbird. And, it's just an incredible relationship of where there is such a need to live, and God has provided everything for that continuation of life. It's all set in place. With the prettiest of things, because flowers are so beautiful and they smell so pretty and everything, and here's this tiny life form that's just incredible. It's so awesome. It really is.
Thank you, Paul. So, from that spiritual lesson, we can see that He makes the inhabitable habitable and beautiful. It's all in your point of view. Dad?
I think one of the main things in the spiritual lesson there is the fact that in genuinely trusting both of a new source, so to speak,
it never gets run down going to places where it's been, it waits till it ferments, so to speak, and there's food source there. He knows that. He knows that. He knows where that source is. And the point spiritually, I believe in that, is a lot to do with the whole idea that the spirit, what? Has many facets. And I can see the whole church of God in that, my friends. I hope you can too.
Yeah, we have to be connected to our Creator to find that source of food. Or we'll waste our energy going to other places, going to other religions. That's a very good point. Jim?
I thought it was so amazing that Paul was bringing out the fact that it seeks its protection in them thorns where nothing else can come. And as they platted the crown of thorns on Christ, where can we come but seek Him and have our life in Him?
Very good, Jim. Very good.
And also, I see it as a type of us, as the church, going out into the world to be like an example to the people around us. And the harvest is just out there, just waiting for us to be a light and an example to them, for them to see and to want to be a part of. And so we can go out to all these different little buds, and we can pass on the Spirit of God to them, and we can get our nutrients from them. But we're like as harmless as doves, but then we can be like serpents too. We can go to all these little creepy places, and we can be a light and an example to other people. And then therefore then we can proclaim God's word, not only by preaching at that point, but by the light that we shine and the works that we do among them. We can just show people how God would want us to be and how He would want them to be, and so that they could want to be like us. And we're trying to be like Christ, okay?
Exactly. There's... right. That's exactly right. That's a good point, because each time that hummingbird sticks its beak into the nectar, it's taking pollen. What's it doing? Spreading that pollen to another flower. So that's exactly what we should be. When we glean from the word, we delve into the meanings of the seed, the atoms, as the gecko did, we're spreading that to another flower. Good point. Okay, so hopefully we can start to understand the characteristics of our Creator, and there's so much meaning in His creation that was never evolved. Okay, the wonderful woodpecker. The woodpecker is totally different from other birds. Every part of his body is especially suited for drilling into wood. His short legs, powerful claws are absolutely essential for holding on tightly to the vertical tree trunks. They are very different from the spindly legs of other birds. The beak of the woodpecker is also very unique. Banging away as much as 100 times a minute, the woodpecker's head has to be much harder than the beaks of other birds. Even more special is the way his beak is connected to his skull. There is a resilient shock-absorbing tissue between the beak and the skull that is not found in any other bird. Or consider the woodpecker's tongue. The remarkable instrument is barbed in most of the 200 or 300 species of woodpeckers found on the earth. It is about 4 times longer than the beak, wrapping around the back of the bird's skull in a very purposeful design. Some species of the woodpecker produce a sticky substance coating the tongue for baiting ants. All of the woodpecker family uses this snake-like tool to penetrate deep into the tree trunk to ferret out ants and grubs. An extracting engineering accident. After realizing just a few of the marvelous details of our little feathered machines, try to imagine how such an invention could be engineered by a collection of rare or superstitious chances. Besides this powerful beak and special tongue, keep in mind that he also has a keen sense of smell. Together with his highly sensitive ears, Mr. Woodpecker can detect insects crawling around under the bark of the tree he's scaling. By the way, how did the mysterious woodpecker learn to climb trees so well? These specially constructed tail feathers are stiff enough to actually brace him securely whenever he grabs a vertical perch. The engineering for such a technological wonder as the woodpecker boggles the mind. Now think about it. If the woodpeckers did evolve, can you imagine the obstacles the early ones could have had to overcome? Think of the primeval headaches due to lack of proper developing cushioning the beak design. Worse yet, think of the broken beaks that weren't hard enough to take all the jackhammering. What about the primal woodpecker's legs and claws in the early days? How on earth did the poor things manage to hang on for dear life, risking everything from the high-class meals at the top? You can't help but wonder, why would this primitive daredevil brother to peck away from grubs in the wood of all places? After all, there has always been plenty of bugs crawling around on the dirt below. It becomes quite apparent, even to the casual birdwatcher, that no supposed ancestral mutant would have ever survived to produce the marvel of God's creative genius we so commonly see today. That was interesting. So what's the spiritual lessons we can glean from the woodpecker? Yeah?
We got to see God.
Like the woodpecking, we've got to dig out the gems or the food. It's not just laying there on top a lot of times. So we have to want it. We have to work for it. And we have to be designed to get it. Or else we're not successful.
Okay. Very good.
And each one of us is designed specially by God. We're being worked on by God right now. We got a special place. Each and every one of us has a special place in the building that God is preparing. And so we're being just like the woodpecker. Some of us, you know, have the hard beaks. Sometimes we can reach around and get the ants on the other side. And they're just a perfect balance that God has in this world that we live in. And that's what He wants us to become. Perfectly balanced, working with one another in harmony. Each one of us has a very, very special gift and talent that God has given to us. And when we can mold that and shape it together, then we can go out and do God's work. And that's what He's doing right now.
I thought it was interesting in the design of the tongue. Actually, there's barbs on the end that they can grab hold, and with the sticky saliva that they have, they can grab hold of the ants or the food. And I think that's interesting in the Word of God, or the Word of our Creator. We should have that to hang on, that barb that hangs on, holds it in our heart. So any other thoughts on the woodpecker?
I think it shows correct design.
Because I see his personality in there. In other words, what I'm saying, I see so many different ways that he wants to attract us to him. So many different ways that he can draw us in. And it shows in each creature, I believe, has a particular message to send to us and how he wants to accomplish that.
Yes, he provides the tools, the hard beaks for some, long tongues, so that we can do our jobs, and the feathers to hold us, the feet as well, to glean what we can.
Within the family of woodpeckers, a person could probably make an argument for evolution, or they would try to do that. But there's a woodpecker in England whose tongue goes out a hole in the back of the head, goes up over the skull, and goes back into the mouth of the woodpecker through a hole in its nose. And it's in that special position to go after the insects and stuff. There's no way for any woodpecker to have wanted to all of a sudden decide, I'm going to stick my tongue out a hole, the back of my head, go up under my skin, over my scalp, and over my skull, and enter in through my nose so that I can procure my meal each day. the whole genus of woodpeckers, each one being so incredible, And if the woodpecker forgets just once to close its eyes upon impact, its eyes will pop out of its skull. And the design of the head of the woodpecker is so unique that brain surgeons in the hospitals look at its skull construction to work on people who have had serious accidents to reattach their brain within their brain cavity because of the design that God has for the woodpecker.
Very good, Paul. Any other thoughts before we move on to the next characteristic? Of seeds of creation. That's what we were learning about. The characteristics that our Creator is looking for in His fellow body, His children. Characteristics. Okay, the inner mystery of the graceful giraffe. Anybody think of a giraffe as graceful? When you see an 18-foot-high crane-like giraffe, you can't help watching the amazing neck as it bobs up and down. The giraffe has one of the largest hearts in the animal world, and nearly double the blood pressure of any other creature. When you consider what a stretch uphill it is to pump the blood to his head, you can see why there's a problem. But what seems like a problem has a marvelous hidden solution. The jugular blood vessels in the neck have a series of one-way check valves to hold back the blood from rushing to the brain when it lowers its head, and to prevent it from flowing away from the brain too quickly when it lifts its head again. An additional protection, a network of spongy tissue at the base of the brain soaks up any excess blood. Could you call this amazing demonstration of plumbing technology? How important do you think this technology is to a giraffe? Now you know how it is when you have been bending down low and then suddenly stand and lift your head. You get a little dizzy, don't you? Think of the giraffe. Can you imagine those valves not working perfectly at any supposed evolutionary stage the first time they bend down for a drink of water and the poor giraffe would literally burst his brains out from all the blood bearing down on his head? The simple act of raising the head up for a nap would result in such a loss of blood from the brain that he would pass out and be easy prey by a nearby lioness. So is there any spiritual lessons we can learn from the plumbing of the giraffe? Jim?
From the trees, the giraffe he gets the top. He gets the very, very best that God has to give us, so to speak. And then when he has to drink, he has to humble himself and bow, so to speak, to get the water, which is the Holy Spirit, which we have to come in that position to attain that. That's what I see.
Any other thoughts? I was thinking about check valves. Controlling our anger and our blood pressure is very essential in spiritual walk towards our brother. I thought that was interesting. Okay, let's get into conclusion. I mentioned the hermit crab. So what does that have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles and the collecting of seeds and the characteristics of our Creator that He's looking for in each one of us? The hermit crab. All the types of crabs on the ocean floor, only one has no protective shell of its own. The hermit crab carries around a hull borrowed from the ocean scrap heap of old shells. This odd crustacean keeps replacing his old house as he grows, and uses his big pincer claw as a door to open the little hideout. Have you heard of the symbiotic relationships between living things? The hermit crab has a symbiotic relationship with sea anemones. Anemones look more like a plant than an animal, but they actually eat like creatures, and they are quite colorful too. Their moving tentacles deliver a paralyzing sting to the slightest touch, but the hermit crab often is seen carrying one of these dangerous hitchhikers around. Stuck on top of its temporary house, these curious cooperation works. well for both creatures. The sea amniote eats food particles left by the crab. The crab is protected from the creatures that would like to eat it, like octopuses, who wouldn't dare disturb the numbing amniote. There is zero evidence that the ancestors of the hermit crab ever had their own attached shells that they later lost. In fact, there would be no evolutionary advantage for a crab to lose its own natural shell and put itself in the vulnerable position of having to find a series of borrowed shells as it grows. To evolve a symbiotic relationship is no simple matter either. Evolution has no suggestion how this amazing programmed information could ever arrive. Survival of the fittest has no explanation for the arrival of the fit. The hermit crabs have a perfect fit in their humble marine neighborhood. This is yet another effect that can only have been caused by the vastly intelligent and powerful creator. So I think that's interesting. Is there any thoughts on the hermit crab? How it relates to characteristics of our seed?
Temporary dwelling.
Any other thoughts about the hermit crab? It goes to the old shells that were left behind by other creatures. That's a very interesting thought. And the humus of the old bones of the scriptures. Any other thoughts?
He doesn't cast out the old man daily, but he's
going to
cast that old man out.
Yes, he does. He has to go through that process of casting out the old man, as Paul said. What are you here? The cooperation of the symbiotic efforts, yes. I think that's very important as we work together, and also representing, as Randy had mentioned, the temporariness of this walk that we are walking. But as we walk, we're learning to develop new homes. And as Paul said, we're casting off that old man and creating a new creature, or a new home, but it's all temporary until our next assignment. And also working with the sea amniotes, but they work together to protect one another, and that's an interesting thought process for us. Do we work together spiritually to ask our elder brother to protect each one of us? But they work together. But they also work together to feed one another is another principle. And so are we working together to feed one another? So I hope you can see in my limited expose that there's a lot to learn about seed collecting, and the greatest seed collector is our Father in Heaven. Before he's collecting characteristics of seeds to last for eternity. And that's really what the Feast of Tabernacles pictures, a growth process of becoming a characteristic seed that he wants, not what we think. Thank you.